Thank you, Menachem, for that very kind and warm introduction. And thank you all for coming out. Colin congratulated you for coming out on a cold and wintry night, which shocked me, frankly, because by the standards not only of Washington, but of Tel Aviv, this is balmy weather for winter. My subject this evening may strike you as odd. The question of whether Israel is or isn't an asset to the West isn't one we bother to ask ourselves. And time and again, we see the leaders of the Western world, the President of the United States, of course, at the forefront, emphasizing the special relationship with Israel. In public opinion polls, in most Western countries, Israel scores very high marks. And they've actually risen in recent years. Sympathy for Israel has grown, while sympathy for the Palestinians has dropped. The latter quite certainly the result of the election of Hamas, which is associated throughout the world with murderous suicide bombings. Why should we even ask ourselves the question of whether Israel is an asset or a liability to the West? Isn't the answer obvious? Most supporters of Israel, when pressed to go a little bit deeper, we'll give two prime rationales why the West should support Israel. One is the West's moral obligation to the Jewish people in the wake of the Holocaust. Israel is something that the West owes to the Jewish people, having inflicted an unprecedented genocide on that people. Now, this is an extremely potent rationale. It was crucial in the creation of Israel. But it isn't clear why that would make Israel an asset to the West. If it's an obligation, then it could be described as a liability, a burden to be borne. And of course, as time passes, as we know, that sense of obligation is bound to diminish. Now, another powerful rationale is the fact that Israel is a democracy. Even an outpost of democracy in a benighted part of the world. Now, it's obvious that any country in which the values of the West prevail is an asset to the West. But the fact is that there are many non-democratic states that have been allies of Western powers and important assets. Quite arguably, the Saudi monarchy is an asset of the West because it assures the flow of oil at reasonable prices, which is a key Western interest. In contrast, the Palestinian Authority and Iran, which have many more democratic practices than Saudi Arabia, are clear threats to the West, having elected to power the likes of Ahmadinejad and Hamas. So the fact that Israel is a democracy is not proof final that it's an asset of the West. Now, the Holocaust argument and the democracy argument are more than sufficient for the vast majority of Americans, and probably for the vast majority of Australians, and for a majority of Europeans. And on this basis alone, they would extend to Israel support, and even unqualified support. And there's an important segment of opinion in America, comprised of evangelical Christians, who probably don't even need these arguments. The creation of Israel is for them a manifestation of a divine plan, and they support it as a matter of faith. But everywhere in the West, there is a sliver of elite opinion that isn't satisfied with these rationales. And they include policymakers, analysts, journalists, academics, and by habit and by preference, they have a tendency to view any consensus as a sacred cow, which, of course, potentially might be slaughtered. And there are quite a few of them who view the West's support for Israel, especially U.S. support for Israel, as a sacred cow that, if it isn't to be slaughtered, should at least be examined and probed for all its flaws. Now, back in March, two American professors subjected the U.S.-Israeli relationship to just such an examination. John Mearsheimer, mere mention of their names.
That's why.
John Mearsheimer and Stephen Waugh, the first from the University of Chicago and the second from Harvard University, published a paper under the title The Israel Lobby, Israel and U.S. Foreign Policy. One version appeared in the London Review of Books, and a longer footnoted version was posted on the website of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. And that paper caused a firestorm. I understand it was even excerpted in one of your newspapers.
Right.
Here.
Yeah.
Now, Mearsheimer and Waugh are two academic high priests of the so-called realist school in international relations. Now, realism, in its policy application, is an approach that seeks to isolate the conduct of foreign affairs from sentimental, moral considerations and from sectoral interests like ethnic lobbies, and to base it on a pure concept of the national interest. Realists aren't interested in historical obligations or whether this or that potential ally respects women's rights. They see themselves as very coldly weighing the U.S. interest, winnowing out all the extraneous considerations and ending up with policies that look out for number one, which is the United States. Now, realist thinkers aren't isolationists. They're not always isolationists. But they are extremely reluctant to see U.S. power expended on projects or on allies that don't directly serve some U.S. interest as they define it. And they define these interests quite rightly. And they define these interests quite narrowly. Now, generally speaking, the realists oppose visionary ideas of global transformation, which they see as American empire in disguise. An empire, they believe, is a drain on American resources. And they're particularly reluctant to commit U.S. troops, preferring that the United States follow a policy of what they call offshore balancing, wherever policy. That is, playing rivals off one another from a distance. These were the principles that guided Professors Mearsheimer and Waugh when they looked at the U.S.-Israel relationship. And this was their finding. By any objective measure, as they saw it, U.S. support for Israel was a liability. It causes Arabs and Muslims to hate America, and that hate in turn generates terrorism. The prime interest of the United States in the Middle East, as they see it, is the cultivation of a sense of shared purpose with Arabs and Muslims, many of whom, of course, detest Israel or its policies or both. The less the United States is identified as a supporter and friend of Israel's 5 million Jews, the easier it will be for the United States to find local proxies and clients to keep order among the billion or so Muslims. And the only thing, according to Professors Waugh and Mearsheimer, that has prevented the United States from seeing this clearly is the pro-Israel lobby, operating through fronts as diverse as AIPAC, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and even homeboy made good, Martin Indyk, at the Brookings Institution. Now, this Israel lobby, with a capital A, capital L, has effectively hijacked U.S. policy in the Middle East, claim the professors, so that it serves Israel's interests and not America's. And one of their most provocative claims, they argue that Israel and its friends in the administration were behind the plan for the Iraq war in order to serve no identifiable U.S. interest, but to make Israel secure. And they continue, the growing drumbeat for an attack on Iran also has its ultimate source in the Israel lobby. A nuclear Iran, they say, wouldn't constitute a threat to the United States. And military action against Iran wouldn't be in the U.S. interest, since it would just inflame Muslim and Arab opinion yet again and produce a wave of anti-U.S. terror and damage the American economy. Now, this Mearsheimer-Waugh thesis, which may sound familiar to you, does sound familiar because it's not new. What's new is the prestige that they gave to these ideas. Because their paper appeared on the Kennedy School website, it soon became known as the Harvard Study on the Israel Lobby. And Harvard may be the most recognizable brand name in the world, the only one in America going clear back to the 17th century, familiar to every American from high school up. So the study couldn't be ignored, and the responses came fast and furious. Now, many of the responses took the form of reiterating the two arguments I mentioned earlier. Israel is a moral obligation of the West, or Israel as a democracy. Now, as I said, these arguments are compelling. But for argument's sake, let's set aside the claim that Israel and the U.S. share democratic values rooted in a common tradition. Let's set aside the fact that the American public has a genuine regard for and sense of debt to Israel connected to the Holocaust, and which shows itself in poll after poll, which it prevents certainly the United States from ever seeing Israel as simply one more Norway. One of the authors of the study argued that if Israel tries to impose an unjust solution on the Palestinians, that the United States should reduce its support for Israel to what he called, quote, the same way that we support a Norwegian state. Let's just ask a simple question. Is Israel a strategic asset or a strategic liability for the United States, and by extension the West, in realist terms, that is, in the terms of their own argument? Now, my answer, to anticipate my conclusion, which I will then substantiate, will be this. U.S. support and Western support for Israel isn't primarily the result of Holocaust guilt or shared democratic values or the machinations of the Israel lobby. U.S. support for Israel, indeed the illusion of its unconditionality, underpins the Pax Americana, the American peace in the Eastern Mediterranean. It has compelled Israel's key Arab neighbors to reach peace with Israel and enter into the American orbit in so doing. And the fact that there hasn't been a general Arab-Israeli war since 1973 is proof that this Pax Americana, the American peace, based on the U.S.-Israel alliance, has been a success. From a realist point of view, support for Israel has been a low-cost way of keeping order in part of the Middle East, managed by the United States from offshore and without the commitment of any forces. It's the ideal realist alliance. Now, in contrast, and we need a contrast, the problems the U.S. faces in the Persian Gulf stem from the fact that the U.S. does not have an Israel equivalent there. And so it has to massively deploy its own force at tremendous cost. And since no one in the Gulf is sure that the United States has the staying power to maintain that kind of presence over time, the Gulf keeps producing defiers of America, from Khomeini to Saddam Hussein to Osama bin Laden to Ahmadinejad. The United States has to counter them, not in the interests of Israel, but to keep the world's great reserve of oil out of the hands of the West's sworn enemies. Now, allow me to substantiate my conclusion with a brief dash the history of Israel's relationship with its primary supporter, the United States. Between 1948 and 67, the United States adhered to a zero-sum concept of the Middle East. The United States recognized Israel in 1948, and Truman's recognition of Israel was extremely important, no doubt. But it didn't do much to help Israel defend itself. Why? Fear of alienating Arab monarchs, the oil sheikhs, the fabled Arab street. Remember that that was the heyday of the sentimental State Department Arabists, and the profit-driven oil companies had a great say. And it didn't matter, by the way, that at that point the Holocaust was at its most vivid. The United States still remained cautious and even attempted to stay even-handed as between Israel and the Arabs. So Israel, for its defense, went elsewhere. Remember, in Israel's War of Independence, where it got its guns? From the Soviet bloc. And later, it received fighter aircraft and a nuclear reactor from France. It even cut a deal with its old adversary, Britain, at the time of the Suez adventure, and that was in defiance of the United States. Israel wasn't in the U.S. orbit, and it didn't get significant American aid. Now, the radical Arab states, for their part, gravitated towards the Soviet Union for weapons and for aid. Israel felt very vulnerable. Arab states still believed they could gain by war. They were preparing constantly for another round. And every decade, this insecurity did produce war. We had war in 1948, 1956, 1967, 1973. Those were general Arab-Israeli wars, state against state. The United States wasn't invested heavily enough to prevent these wars. Its diplomacy was just kicking in to stop them after the initial energy was spent. Now, already in June 67, the U.S. began to see Israel in a different light because it defeated three of its neighbors in 6 days. It began to see Israel as perhaps a military power, which had been underestimated. But the perception really changed, and this is a paradox, in October 73. We consider October 73 to be a disaster. Israel was surprised, 3,000 soldiers killed. But although Egypt and Syria launched a surprise attack against Israel, Israel bounded back to achieve what military analysts, the people in the Pentagon, saw as its greatest victory. Repulsing an enemy that might have overwhelmed a less determined and resourceful people. And it was then that the United States really began to look at Israel differently, as a potential ally. Israel appeared to be the strongest, most reliable, most cost-effective bulwark against Soviet penetration in the Middle East. Why? Because it could defeat any combination of Soviet clients, and in so doing, humiliate the Soviet Union, which was a prime Cold War objective, and drive thinking Arabs out of the Soviet camp. The 1973 war also had another impact on U.S. thinking. Remember, until then, there had been Arab-Israeli wars, but they didn't threaten the flow of oil. But that war led to an Arab oil embargo. And that meant that yet another Arab-Israeli war might have the same impact, or worse. So the United States resolved to get more involved, to prevent such wars by creating a security architecture, what I call the Pax Americana, the American peace. Now, how did it do that? One way would have been to squeeze Israel relentlessly. But the United States understood that making Israel feel less secure would only increase the likelihood of another war. It would also encourage the Arab states to prepare for yet another round. So instead, the U.S. solution was to show such strong support for Israel as to make the Arab states despair of defeating it and fearful of the cost of trying, and to bring Israel entirely into the U.S. orbit, to make of it a dependent client through arms and aid. And that worked. The expanded U.S. support for Israel persuaded Egypt to switch camps, moving from the Soviet Union to the United States. That won the Cold War in the Middle East for the United States. Egypt became an American ally alongside Israel, and not instead of Israel, integrated into the overall Pax Americana. The zero-sum theory of the Arabists, which was that you were either allied with Israel or the Arabs, collapsed. U.S. Middle East policy underwent what I would call a Copernican revolution. Now, before 73, the Arab states thought they might defeat or destroy Israel by some stroke of luck. They tried their hand in 48 and 67, 73. Since 1973, ladies and gentlemen, think of how long that is. 34 years now, 33 years. The Arab states have understood not only that Israel is strong, but the United States is Israel's guarantor, and we have had no general Arab-Israeli war, no state-to-state war. Now, as a result, As I said, there have been no wars between states. And Israel's Arab neighbors have either made peace with it, Egypt and Jordan, or kept their border quiet. We have the example of Syria. The eastern Mediterranean, part of the Middle East, for all the saturation coverage it gets. And of course, despite Israel's confrontations with the Palestinians, which don't rise to the level of a general war, it's still been free of crises that have required any direct American military intervention. And this is due to U.S. support for Israel, support that appears so unequivocal in the eyes of Arab states that they've despaired of overturning it. Now, U.S. support for Israel has enhanced its standing in another way, as the only force in Arab eyes that can possibly persuade Israel to cede territory that it's occupied since 67. And here's another paradox. The United States has been a major beneficiary of the Israeli occupation of Arab territories, because Arab leaders who wish to regain lost territory have to pass an American test. It began with Sadat. And when they do, the United States rewards them. And the result has been a whole network of U.S.-endorsed agreements based on U.S.-mediated Israeli concessions. And it's this peace process that has turned even revolutionary Arab leaders into supplicants at the White House door. They wouldn't be there if a strong Israel didn't hold something they wanted, if the United States, as Israel's ally, weren't in a position to deliver it. Now again, I ask you to compare this situation to the Gulf, the Persian Gulf, where U.S. allies are weak. And there, the absence of a strong ally has wreaked havoc with U.S. policy and forced the U.S. to intervene itself repeatedly. There was the Shah, once deemed a U.S. pillar, collapsed in the face of an anti-American upsurge, produced the humiliation of the embassy seizure in Tehran, and this hostile and entrenched and terror-sponsoring regime that is still bent on driving the United States out of the Gulf. And then Saddam Hussein, who for some years afterwards was America's ally instead of the Shah, launched an 8-year bloody war against Iran that produced waves of anti-U.S. terror, only to turn against the United States by occupying Kuwait and threatening Saudi Arabia. So these are feckless friends and unreliable. And absent a strong ally in the region, the United States itself has had to deploy and deploy and deploy again. In the Kuwait and Iraq wars, it has put something like 1 million sets of boots on the ground in the Persian Gulf, at a cost that I think surely exceeds $1 trillion, $1,000 billion. It's precisely because the Gulf doesn't have an Israel that is a strong and capable local ally that the U.S. can't balance from offshore. If the United States is not perceived as willing to send in troops, and it will only be perceived as such if it sometimes does send them, then the big nationalist states, formerly Iraq, now Iran, will attempt to muzzle Saudi Arabia and the smaller Arab Gulf states, which have, of course, bigger reserves of oil. In the Gulf, the United States, at the end of the day, really has no allies. It has only dependencies. And their defense is going to continue to drain American resources and Western resources until the day people give up their big cars and their SUVs. In Israel, in contrast, the U.S. is an ally to a militarily adept and economically vibrant state that keeps its part of the Middle East in a balance. The U.S. has to maintain that balance, needs diplomacy, peace plans, diplomatic initiatives. But this is really a relatively low cost compared to what we see expended in the Gulf. And many of the costs actually flow back to the United States. Arms sales, aid given to Israel, the weaponry bought from the United States, Israeli technological innovations, again, re-exported back to the United States, and so on. In the overall scheme of the Pax Americana, then, U.S. policy toward Israel and its neighbors over the past 30 years has been a tremendous success. Has the U.S. brought this final land lies down with the lion peace? No. Issues are too complex. Are the Arabs happy about U.S. support for Israel? Of course not. They still dream of pushing Israel off the map. But any time U.S. interests are upheld without the dispatch of U.S. troops, it's a success. Let me deal summarily with two other arguments before I conclude. There is the argument that U.S. support for Israel is the source of popular resentment, which propels recruits to Al-Qaeda. You know that. Resentment of Israel is a source of terrorism. I don't know any serious terrorism expert who subscribes to this notion. Israel's been around for 60 years. It's always faced terrorism. Countless groups are devoted to it. But never has a terror group emerged devoted solely or even primarily to attacking the U.S. for its support of Israel. Terrorists devoted to killing Americans emerged only after the U.S. enlarged its military footprint in the Persian Gulf. That's when Al-Qaeda emerged, when the U.S. sent forces to Saudi Arabia. And even when Al-Qaeda and its affiliates mentioned Palestine as a grievance, it's always one grievance in a list. The other grievance is being U.S. support for authoritarian Arab regimes, and now, of course, the U.S. presence in Iraq. And speaking of Iraq, we're left with the argument that the U.S. went to war there at the impetus of the Israel lobby. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this is just a falsehood. It's quite easy to show that in the year preceding the Iraq War, Israel time and again disagreed with the United States, arguing that Iran posed the greater threat. Now, of course, Israel shed no tears over Saddam's demise, and it gave full support to the U.S. once the Bush administration had made its choice to go to war in Iraq. But I refer you to my own website, martincramer.org. There's an article I wrote there entitled Israel and the Iraq War for detailed refutation of the Walt Mearsheimer claim, which is simply untrue. And as for the suggestion that only Israel is really threatened by an Iranian nuclear capability, this is to succumb completely to Iran's anti-Israel rhetoric and to underestimate Iran's ambition to be a decisive power in the Gulf. Remember that just before Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, what did he threaten? Does anyone remember? People forget. He said he would burn half of Israel. You remember that? Colin told me that was on the cover of one of his magazines.
Yeah.
Yes. Why did he do that? The threat was meant to win Arab Muslim support. But his real objective was to stand like a colossus astride the Gulf with its oil. And so he invaded Kuwait. And I think this is also unquestionably the ambition of Iran. Their first priority is not the destruction of Israel, but driving the United States from its position of dominance in the Persian Gulf. And its nuclear blackmail notes are far more likely to be delivered against the United States, and more importantly, against its allies in the Gulf than against Israel. So, ladies and gentlemen, U.S. support for Israel, indeed the illusion, as I said, of its unconditionality, has compelled Israel's Arab neighbors to join the Pax Americana, or at least acquiesce in it. And I would expect realists, of all people, to appreciate the success of this policy. I mean, after all, the United States manages the American peace in the Eastern Mediterranean from offshore, out of line of sight, and isn't this precisely what realists think the U.S. should stand? A true realist, I would think, would recoil from any policy shift that might threaten to undermine the Pax Americana in the Eastern Mediterranean. And among the many perplexing things in the Mearsheimer wallpaper, I think certainly none is as perplexing as this. If the United States were to adopt what they call an even-handed policy, this might actually increase Israeli insecurity and stoke Arab ambitions. And were such a policy to overshoot its mark, and policies overshoot their mark all the time, it could raise the likelihood of an Arab-Israeli war, maybe even the only kind that could endanger access to oil. Now, why would anyone tempt fate and endanger an absolutely vital American interest by doing just that? And that's why I see the Mearsheimer wallpaper as a betrayal of the very realism they supposedly represent. And sometimes I wonder whether they're realists at all. It seems to me that the aim of U.S. policy should be the construction of an American peace, not what they call a just peace. One that serves U.S. interests and not the unstable claims of justice, which Walter Mearsheimer said should drive U.S. policy towards the Palestinians. It's sometimes said that neoconservatism is the opposite of what its name implies, that it's not conservative, it's a radical revolutionary doctrine. I think the same thing may well be true of realism. It's anything but realistic. Now I conclude. The arguments for support of Israel are many and varied, and no one argument, of course, is decisive. Moral arguments, and values-based arguments are crucial. But a compelling, realist argument can also be made for viewing Israel as an asset to the West. And frankly, it doesn't take a lobby to explain this to the hard-nosed strategic thinkers in the White House and in the Pentagon. Of course, Israel welcomes help from friends. But it doesn't need all of the organizations that claim to be working on its behalf. Because the rationale for keeping Israel strong, I think, is hardwired into the realities of the Middle East. The U.S. and the West just don't have an alternative ally of comparable power. And if the institutions of the lobby were to disappear tomorrow, I think it's quite likely that the U.S. would continue its support unabated. And I think that Israel looms so large as a valuable ally and asset in this tumultuous Middle East is something in which we should all take pride. Thank you.